Hello and welcome to the Cyber Sisters podcast. We're your Cyber Sisters, Allison and Emily, two cyber educators talking ed tech pedagogy and this week, critical racial justice with Nakia Minas. Welcome to the show, Nakia. We're so excited to have you. For our listeners, Nakia Primus is an associate professor at Millersville University. Her primary teaching responsibilities include preparing future educators in a wide variety of degree programs. She received her Bachelor's in Art in English Literature from Tufts University, a Master's of Arts in Teaching English from Duke University, and a PhD in Education from the University of Delaware. Nakia's passion for the written word emerged early as she found solace and sanctuary in the New York City public libraries. From Ezra Keats to Toni Morrison, her affinity for language and text spans all genres and forms. Welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate you all inviting me onto your podcast. This is going to be fun. I look forward to, you know, learning and growing and hopefully helping some future teachers or current teachers in this space. Thank you for having me.
We're so excited that you're here. I had the pleasure of being in one of your sessions at the virtual conference that Millersville hosted. And when we were over the summer and when Allison and I were brainstorming guests to have on our podcast, I was like, oh, we got to have her. She was so good. I know I heard a little bit about your backstory, but can you tell us more about your journey as an educator and what brought you to teaching and learning as a profession?
Definitely. My journey into the realm of education was a circuitous jaunt. Let me use all my syllables, right? I initially thought when I was in high school that I was going to be an obstetrician gynecologist. I wanted to deliver babies and be with the little people and help moms in that way. And then I took AP bio and the good Lord slapped me down like, no, this is not going to work. I was in my AP bio class in high school reading novels under the desk and not paying attention. I'm sorry, Mrs. McVeary. I just didn't pay attention. And it was my AP English teacher when it was time to start preparing for, you know, the college admissions process and what to major in. She and I had a very frank and honest conversation. And I said, Mrs. Crowley, I really think I want to pursue English as a major, but, you know, everybody's telling me that I'm not going to make any money and that I'm not going to be able to get a job. What do you think I should do? And I had Mrs. Crowley for two English classes, for my 10th grade English and also for my 11th grade English class. And so we knew each other. We had a great relationship. And she said, you should do the thing that your heart really wants to do when you go to college. It'll be the only time in your life where you can pursue something that you really love. And then all that other stuff will fall in place. And so that's what I did. My second semester as a freshman at Tufts University, I declared myself an English major. And then a year later, I also tacked on American Studies because I was really interested in the whole notion of race and identity and our American society. And it turned out to be one of the best dual majors for me. In the process of being an undergraduate at Tufts, I also did all the kinds of things that pre-teachers tend to do, but I wasn't looking at it that way. Quite frankly, I just needed a job that paid and that would allow me to, you know, be a little more independent. And coming from New York City, I had, you know, had many jobs. I was in retail and all that kind of thing. And since I'm also the oldest of three children, again, I think in some ways I had been groomed towards some of these nurturing and teaching oriented type skills. And so I took jobs on campus that allowed me to work with students. I was a tutor. I was an admissions officer, like ambassador. I gave tours on campus. All the things that you don't think actually help you teach, I was doing, working with the public. I worked at the info booth for like a long time and just being a resource for people on campus, visitors, parents. Oh yeah, you need to know where the library is. I can tell you how to get there in the shortest amount of time, that kind of thing. And my junior year of college at Tufts, I randomly took an education class. Now, Tufts is not known for, you know, creating future teachers, but we had this intro to education called School and Society. I will never, ever, ever, ever forget this class with Stephen Cohen. And he was a longtime instructor. He had worked in the Boston public school system for forever. And I had heard that this class was really good. Okay, it was an elective. It wouldn't have necessarily counted anything for me, but I wanted to take the class. That class changed my life. And one of our assignments in that class was to create our own school. And I worked with two people who I'm still in contact with today, both of whom are in education in various capacities. And we created a school called BAM Academy. It was our initials. We were not very, you know, creative in that. And, you know, this was almost 20 years ago. So I'm thinking about this school right now because you made me think about it. I'm like, wow, man, I wish that school existed today. And so that experience kind of dropped a seed in my spirit. And when I graduated from college, it still wasn't on my like radar, like, oh, go pursue education as a career. I still thought that I was going to be in the English realm, like whether it would be an editor or a, you know, a publicist or some kind of book curator with a major publishing house. Those were my dreams because I really, really loved to read so much. And I thought, wow, I could just do this forever. And then I had an internship doing that exact thing. And I was like, yeah, no, because I was in a cubicle in New York City with no windows and no interaction with people. Now, I am the best introvert. I am the best introvert there is. Trust me when I tell you I like my own company. But that was painful. Oh my goodness, it was painful. And so that year after college, I said, okay, well, what can I do? You know, mom's like, you need to get a job. You need to get a job. You know how that goes. And so I applied for like an after-school lead teacher for some kindergartners in New York City. And that was when that little seed germinated. I learned two things in that position that I did for a year, a school year. Number one, I like teaching and learning. Number two, I'm not so great with kindergartners.
Not my specialty either.
you know the cartoon from the 90s, Recess?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was like that. It was incredibly like that. I mean, and I loved all the hugs and wanting to sit on my lap and all that kind of great stuff. But I was like, oh my goodness, I can't, you know, I can't do the snotty nose. I can't do the crying and the whining. And so when I realized, oh, wow, I really like this. I'm really good at it. I just don't know if I want to do it with this age range. Then I decided to pursue my graduate degree because I went to Tufts as an English major and only had taken one English class, which was, you know, this intro to education. And I applied to Duke. I wanted to get back out of the city. And I got in and it was a Master of Arts in Teaching program. And I feel like I got the best preparation to be a teacher ever. Part of the reason that I feel that way is because it focused heavily on more content, right? So I took, I would say 75% of my classes during that program were more geared toward English, language, literature, grammar, all that. And you know, that's my alley. You know, I got to read all kinds of things. I got to create an independent study on graphic novels. And at the time, many kids were not reading them. I was reading them, but many kids were not. And so I was able to infuse my interest into my course of study. And then the education classes that we took were fused with a year-long internship. And at the time, that wasn't the norm. You know, most of us have done induction programs where you'll be lucky if you get 3 or 4 weeks by yourself somewhere, right? I was in a classroom with two different mentors full-time the entire school year.
That's ideal.
And it was so awesome. I got to teach two different levels of students. I got to teach 9th grade students and 12th grade students. So that, you know, that spectrum. I got to teach, you know, on grade level and AP or honors. So I really got to stretch myself. And what I say most about my mentors, Miss Delgado and Miss Moore, Linda Moore, those two women in Durham, North Carolina, did something that I try to do with my students now. They let me fail. They let me fail. They let me fail a lot. And not like, yeah, you're flat on your face. They let me make mistakes in a safe way. They let me try things that I was like, hey, I don't know if this is going to work well. Why don't you try it? And they never undermined my authority with the students when I made a mistake. And so that was an incredible, like, I don't think I could have ever gotten a better experience than that. And so from there, I did one of my teaching internships at a local high school in North Carolina, Durham, North Carolina. And that next year they hired me. And so I started my teaching career, my formal, you know, teaching career immediately after graduate school. And then as life would have it, and you know how life goes, boys and girls like each other. And I decided to move. And so I you know, moved from North Carolina to Pennsylvania and continued teaching and shifted down from the high school to the middle school, where I spent the vast majority of my time. And that was another learning experience, because I didn't think that I would like middle schoolers, you know, like I was traumatized by the kindergartners, and I felt like, you know, middle school was like a circus, but it turned out to be where my niche was. I love that age. And if I love it, they still have the wonder, they still have the curiosity of elementary school, but they also have this developing sense of self that can be useful when you're teaching something like English and language arts. And as luck would have it, I was, you know, doing my thing and, you know, pursuing a PhD at the same time, not because I thought I wanted to go into higher ed, but because I'm a nerd and nerds just want to learn. One of my instructors at the University of Delaware happened to also be a faculty member at Millersville University. And I got this random phone call one day saying, hey, we have a position open. I think you should apply for it. And my first inclination was, no, thank you. I'm good. I'm all right. I'm in my groove. I'm not a new teacher. I'm well into my veteran season years. I'm coasting. And that's when I realized, like, maybe that's the problem, Nakia. Like, you're doing this and you're doing it well and you're enjoying it, but you don't have the level of challenge that, you know, your disposition would, you know, you like. And so maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, he calls back. Are you sure you don't want to apply? Are you sure? And I said, fine, you know, because I'm a people pleaser. Fine, I'll apply. I'll do it. And I did it. I did all the stuff, did all the things. And then it was time for an interview. And then I got scared. And I said, you know what? Never mind. I don't want to do this anymore. And again, he said, okay. You know, again, letting me just kind of figure it out for myself. And I think the biggest fear for me at this point in my educational journey was, can I be a good voice for future educators? You know, I knew my realm. I knew how to work with my students. I knew what they needed. And I could kill a lesson in the middle school classroom. That was not a problem. But I remember oftentimes in grad school, especially, and sometimes in undergrad, feeling as though some of my professors were out of touch. And I didn't want to be that person.
Absolutely.
I struggled with, well, am I leaving my kids? Because they're still my kids. Am I leaving my kids for something that I'm not going to be effective in helping these students be, you know, develop into? And I dealt with that. You know, I did my meditation and prayer and all that good stuff. And I came to the realization that this is another opportunity for me to learn. And because I had this foundation in my induction and throughout my career where I was surrounded by people who were supportive, who allowed me to stretch myself and maybe sometimes fail, but safely, who collaborated with me willingly and who I could always ask questions, that was kind of what cinched the deal. And so for someone to say, you know what, I think you would be good at this, I took the leap and I did it. And higher education is very different than K-12. There are nuances and structures that many people on the outside don't realize that exist and that can be challenging at times. But I've found my focus on the students and making sure future teachers, as I said in the other conference, do no harm, right? I am a brown woman who grew up in New York City public schools, who had an opportunity to go to a Catholic school because I was a nerd, quite frankly. but so many of my experiences in education have been confronting other people's expectations that were often less than, right? I never had a person of color, a black person, teach me, except maybe one throughout my entire post-secondary career. So I have 3 degrees. I went through a bachelor's program, a master's program, and a PhD program, and only had one university professor that was a person of color.
Wow.
And so for me, my presence given and also my interest, I think will benefit future teachers. And so that's kind of where I am. I mean, I answered very long.
We love a good long answer here. And I think your story has so much to learn from. I really resonated with huge parts of your story. I think because I also had a very winding path to education. I did not go to college expecting to be a teacher. And when I became a teacher, I definitely did not expect middle school to be where I landed. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important for people, I think in general, to hear that your career can and should be a bit of a winding path of you doing a certain amount of self-reflection and really being driven in different directions, that we are sort of past, I feel like, as a society, the time where you pick the thing that you want to be when you're like 7 and you go to school for it. And, you know, you just do that same job for the rest of your life, right? Like, it really is a continual process of questioning. And I think that in education, we still a little bit have that myth, right? That teachers are, you know, little girls who grew up, you know, teaching to their dolls. Mm-hmm. And that's not the educator that I know out there in the world. And I think that it's so important for us, especially because as a podcast community, we really do cater especially to new and young teachers, for people to hear that it's okay that maybe you didn't decide to be a teacher until a little bit later, or that in the process of teaching, you're trying to find, you know, your groove and the place where you fit, because ultimately there is a place for you in this community, right? And I think that that's so incredibly important. I also think that one of the things that you mentioned sort of right at the end there is incredibly important, which is that we simply do not have enough diversity in education. We do not have enough Black and Brown teachers in our community. And I think that one of the most important places where we can be making a difference is by having more teachers with a variety of life experiences, right? Because there's only so much that Emily and I can do to really speak to and provide for every community, right? It always has to be a teaching community that is teaching a community of students. One teacher can never shoulder the burden of every community. Yeah. One of the things that I'd love to talk a little bit about is, how do we have critical racial sort of discussion in your classroom? I know that this is something that at the end of last year, especially, a lot of teachers in my teaching community were having really robust conversations about, and there was a lot of disparity, right, in experiences. There were teachers who were really gung-ho and ready to sort of have these conversations. There were teachers who were a lot more hesitant. There were teachers who, I think, wanted to really engage but felt a lot of fear and discomfort. And we felt like this is a place where a conversation sort of needs to be had, especially with younger educators, because this is such a vital thing, right? It's not optional to talk about race, especially if you're a history or an English teacher, right? Like, mm-hmm. this has to be there. It has to be done. And I think that over time, what those conversations have looked like have really changed. So I think from your perspective, how have you seen critical racial discussion change, maybe from the time that you were in school yourself to you actually being in the classroom with middle schoolers to today? Do you see that as a place where there's been a lot of growth and a lot of change? Were there beneficial conversations that you feel like did exist? Or is this still one of these places where we just have a long way to go?
Well, that's a good question.
we try to ask the good ones here, right? Like, if we're going to do it, let's do it.
Let's do it. I am of the opinion that critical conversations around race, around gender, around ability, or whatever, are ever present in our classrooms, in our in our homes, in our workplaces, wherever, even if they're not actively engaged, even if there is silence around them, because that silence is messaging. That silence or invisibility provides a viewpoint and a perspective. It says that this is not important. It says we don't talk about that. It says we value other things and prioritize other things or concepts or forms of knowledge above this. Now, we don't want to, we as the education community, not just us here, we don't want to admit that, right? Because critical conversations where oppression of any kind exists are apparent in our everyday lives. They exist in how we think about what does classroom management look like? It's embedded in there. When you think about how a student, quote unquote, should behave, right? Or how parents should engage with the school community, or how we deal with which types of students get access to honors classes and band, or, you know, the advanced art, or go on field trips, or don't go on field trips, or don't have access. Like, so the system of education, the structure of schools in general, the conversation is already there. It's just whether or not people are picking up the microphone and having dialogue with one another. So we're making all kinds of choices and decisions around these issues. It's just, for me, my perspective, it's just a matter of if we are actively engaging, dismissing, or suppressing the conversation. So I'll start there. And so for me, my experience as a student, as a parent, and as an educator informed that. So for me, I grew up in New York City, and many of the conversations around race or gender or any form of systemic oppression or individual experiences of discrimination were very much apparent. Part of the reason it was apparent is because I live in a body that is very different from the majority of the people in our society. So early on in my life, my parents made it very clear that certain opportunities, certain modes of thinking, certain ways of being would have to be adjusted, would have to fit, would have to, I would have to be more aware of that. It's not a fair conversation, but it helped prepare me for some of the things that I had to interact with, right? In terms of skin color, in terms of why are we always talking about George Washington all the time, right? From kindergarten through fourth grade, I think we learned about George Washington every single year, who are different, like Martin Luther King. Why is he the only person that we talk about during Black History Month? There are like thousands of, you know, people that, because I had really hands-on parents, especially my mother, when she became a single mom, she took us to the library all the time, and she never shied away from our questions, right? And I'm paying for it now because I have an 11-year-old who is exactly like I was. But she, like, she would ask, like, I would say, Mom, I don't know, what is a volcano? And she would say, I don't know. Like, she knew what it was, but she was like, let's go to the library so you can get a book and you can read about it and then you can tell me about it. So like the opportunity to question things was always there in my young upbringing. And I brought that into the classroom. And one of my first experiences as a student was being told that I asked too many questions. But, you know, this student over here who didn't look like me or didn't live in the section of the city that I lived in could ask all the questions like that. You know, those kinds of things happened all the time and persisted even to this day as a faculty member at a university. So just to wrap up my thought about how do I have these conversations, or why do I think they're necessary? I think they're necessary solely because the impact of the oppressive systems that we live in, all of us, women face them, men face them because they internalize certain things and project them, people of color, people with disabilities, LGBTQ plus people, the impact is so real. And a lot of the time when we don't acknowledge the thing, our ignorance does more harm than, you know, keeping face or like trying to save us from those hurt feelings of addressing them. Am I making sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have so many comments, but I want you to finish saying things.
And so when you said it's not optional,
yeah,
that is because I think, and I hear you, but for a lot of people, it is optional because it's a privilege, right? It's a privilege to circumvent certain kinds of conversations. It's a privilege not to acknowledge certain realities, but not everybody has that. And when we do that, we continue to solidify this hierarchy where certain voices, certain experiences, certain people don't matter. And so when I engage with my students who are primarily white young women, I tell them, listen, I am not here to proselytize to you. That this is not the Black church. I'm not asking you to come, you get saved or anything like that. That is not going to happen with me. What I am going to do is confront what you think you know consistently and with care, because you are going to go into the world and teach all my kids, not just the ones that look like me, not just the ones who come from the demographic background that I have, because my kids are going to interact with your kids, and I want your kids to be allies and advocates and really authentic friends to my kids. And I don't want my kids to feel like they have to put up walls or boundaries because your kids have a limited perspective or don't want to address certain things, right? We do harm to all of the kids when we avoid these conversations. So I'm going to plant a seed. That's my job. And I'll tell you, and I tell my students this, I'm a really good gardener, right? I'm a really, really good gardener. So I'm going to water that seed. I'm going to pull the weeds out. You may hate me after this semester or, you know, this year is over, but I'm going to do it with care. I'm going to make sure that I'm asking about how you think and walking you through whatever journey it is. And there are a lot of professors and academics out there that say, oh, that's too much emotional work. That's too much emotional labor. I'm not with that. I'm not for that. See, that's a limiting factor. Mm-hmm. Yes, it requires a lot. And I'm not the only person doing this, and I'm not the only person of color doing this. And there are people who are not people of color who are doing this, right? But in order to move the dial, we have to do two things. We have to work with the individual, and we have to work with the system. Some systems need to be reimagined, dismantled, just like plucked out like weeds and thrown away. Other systems have a little bit more hope. And for me, the school system is a place that has a little bit more hope. I'm not yet at the point where it's like, you know what, scrap this whole thing and let's just start over. I'm not there yet. And if I ever get to that place, then maybe it's time for another career change. Maybe it's time to do something else. But I feel that with fostering these types of critical conversations around all kinds of issues, we as an educators become more empowered to enact change. And I'm very much of the opinion that that change does not need to look or feel or be the same for every educator, right? So you have those who are like gung-ho, let's tear it down. Okay, we need some of those. But we also need some people who are going to get on the floor with some four-year-olds and talk about difference. We also need some people who are going to talk to those crazy squirrely middle schoolers and have conversations about how social media, it can be used to foster critical conversations in the classroom. We also need those people who are going to write letters to senators and congress people. We need all of it, right? Now, there is no one way to act. And so for me, I like to pay very close attention to what my students bring in. But as I said, I'm a good gardener. I'm going to drop this seed and I'm not just going to leave it there. I'm going to pick and prod and care and push and water and put you in direct sunlight sometimes, and it might burn, but I'm going to put you back in the shade sometimes. and, you know, give you some covering, allow you to ask questions, and then let you be. I might just leave you alone for a little bit and let it sit, let it marinate. Because the worst thing I think is to push a person to do or be something that they're not. I feel everybody needs to grow into their advocacy. Everyone needs to grow into their allyship. And we need to respect that process, because systems won't change with people who are not ready or don't really have the skills to do it.
I feel like I can tell so much from your response, not just about your passion for why we need to have these conversations and for making meaningful change, but also for being an educator, right? Like, I can really hear how responsive you are with your students, how much you're putting in. And I think both Emily and I have had those professors before. I think many of our listeners have as well, that sort of really leave something untended. And so just thank you, I think truly from the bottom of our hearts as sort of surrogates for your students for not being that professor. We need so many like you right now, I think, in education. To sort of go back to an earlier point that you made about how being in certain bodies, right, Black and brown bodies in particular, but certainly I think other kinds of bodies face sort of similar issues, right, really do affect the way that they are seen. I know that it reminded me very much, I think, in cyber education, one of the places that we are constantly trying to work and constantly trying to think about is representation, right, and making sure that our students are able to be seen. And I think that very often, that challenge is so much more than we could have imagined. I remember at the beginning of my teaching career, we used to have, you know, some sustained silent reading days, and I wanted to have something as simple as a slide that at the very beginning said, let's read, and showed a happy child reading. Mm-hmm. I thought this was going to be a very simple thing to do. but when I went to go look for stock photos that included just different kinds of students reading, I was very easily able to find white students who were happily reading, and not the same white student, right? Mm-hmm. So white students who looked like nerds, and ones who looked like jocks, and ones who, you know, were part of a family and who expressed their style differently, right? There were all different kinds of kids that I could choose from to represent that demographic. But the second that I've stepped outside of that, the stock photos that I was able to find were very, very different. Mm-hmm. All of the sudden, I want to have a little Black boy in class reading. There has to be a teacher sort of standing over him while he makes like a frowny face, right? Mm-hmm. Or there may be a little Black girl reading, but they all look like the same little Black girl, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's no variety in her personality and the person that she is. And I think that as educators, that was a big moment for me, because this was a simple thing, right? This was what I thought of as the minimum that I could do as a teacher to make sure that my students felt represented, is to just have a picture of a child reading. And even that small thing had a huge barrier. And I think it really was a big moment in shifting the way that I thought about how strong those systematic barriers are. And I do think it's important that as a community of educators, right, you mentioned sort of the point about privilege. And I think that as a community, we have to do a much better job of making sure that you may have the ability to be silent about this issue in a variety of other areas, but in education, we're going to hold you accountable, right? If you're going to be a teacher, your community needs to be there supporting your ability to have those conversations and to address that.
The conversation is moving, you know, whether we're doing it intentionally or not. I mean, and most of us, I believe, are working in a space of like a veiled gaze, right? We don't see because that's how the system works, what works best. Right? We don't see those kinds of things unless we intentionally take the veil off. That's just the first step. Like, oh, that's what happened this spring. There's a lot of people, Black, brown, whatever, who were forced to take the veil off. Oh, wow. I didn't know it looked like this out here. And then, you know, what tends to happen is people stop there because it's jarring. It's like getting on a roller coaster that was made in 1920. It's like, what? Wow, like, this is too much. Because they say ignorance is bliss, right? You go back and you're like, oh, I don't see. There's some people who just stop. And my job as an educator at the university, and just in general, is to make you feel less jarred, less like, woo, jolted, and like, okay, this is something, this is real. How can I process these feelings and emotions? How can I tie them to the system and not to me, right? Oftentimes it becomes this personal battle between, well, I'm not and I didn't. That's not the point. The point is, this is the reality, and how can we move to a place where there are less people harmed? You too, because you have been harmed, whomever that person is, because that veil is so thick, it has blinded you to possibilities even you didn't imagine. Like, I think about the teachers who didn't realize that they could do certain things, that they could create certain things because it was so thick. Like, how can we move in a right, in a more positive direction once we are more aware and not take it as personally as some would have us, but also recognizing that there is a system and that we live in a society and certain things were meant to be this way, right?
Right.
And so once that happens, critical conversations don't just happen any particular way. I mean, I am not the list person. I'm not the best practice person. I think that those are so trite. I am a dialogian. I believe that it is best to meet people where they are. Little people, big people, old people, nice people, mean people, whatever. And there are some people who are not yet and probably may never want to have these conversations. I'm not going to force it. Okay, that is the benefit of living in an American society. We have diverse opinions. We have diverse perspectives. And if that is your opinion and your perspective, like I said, my job is just to drop the seed there. If you decide at the end of this semester or even throughout this semester to keep taking it out, okay, I'm just going to keep plucking it, putting it back there. No problem. I've had that happen. And then at the end, if you still decide, yeah, no, this is not for me, okay. And I can move on from that. I'm not going to hate you. I'm not going to say you're unreachable or anything like that. You're just not there. You're not ready. Or you may never want to be. And that is okay. And we spend so much time making people feel bad for things that they believe when we could be doing other things, reaching the people who actually want to hear from us, right?
Right.
Where I get, where I get a little more like assertive is when I ask the question. So, you know, you have your beliefs and you are entitled to them. And we're talking about, let's say, race, because that's easier.
Right.
And I say to a student or to a friend or to a colleague or whomever, a stranger, you intend to go teach in a school district. And I don't care if that school district has 99.9% white students. I'm telling you, there's diversity there. So your perspective is going to limit your capacity to be an effective teacher. You may not think so, but you may hinder and harm your capacity to help those students, whether they're kindergartens, first graders, ninth graders. Your perspective, if you embody it and wear it and move in that space, may hinder your ability to be an effective teacher. Are you okay with that? And then I just leave it alone. And, you know, 9.9 times out of 10, they think. And that's all I ask. Just think. Because even if you're in a school that's 99.9% white, you will have kids who live in trailer parks. You'll have kids with disabilities. Mm-hmm. You have kids with blue mm-hmm. eyes and brown eyes. You'll have kids whose mom and dad are present, whose mom and dad are not. You'll have kids who are in foster care, who've been exposed to drugs, who have some life-threatening illness. There's always difference. And if your perspective is that only certain types of people need to learn, can learn, should learn, maybe you should reconsider this education thing as a career. And that's all I say. And then from there, the critical conversations come with, like I said in my presentation, just telling the truth. And see, the truth is wide and deep. So I present my students and anyone who wants to have a conversation with all types of information and perspectives, even if I don't agree with them. I feel and I think very deeply that I do harm if I am just on a soapbox saying, you need to do this, you need to do that, and never present alternative perspectives or alternative voices, right? So take, if I use current events or use news media, I use as many news outlets and media sources as possible, and sometimes even fake news, just to poke, just to prod, just to problematize why you think what you think. And so I'm not afraid to use things that may even be like offensive to me personally. Like I've used, so for example, in one of my classes a couple years ago, a school district decided to give out awards to its students. And you know, we're in a society where everybody gets an award, right? Mm-hmm. And so these awards were personality based, but were often tinged in racial, socioeconomic, and gender-based stereotypes. Like, so let's say Toya would get the award for being the most loud student ever. And this was written on an award paper. So Toya gets this paper and it goes home to her parent. And let's say little Bob from down the road, he gets the perfect attendance award because he has two parents that can drop him off on time all the time. And yep. So, you know, we look at these and I ask my students, what's going on here? And then without a doubt, I'll have, well, everybody got an award. Yeah, but let's look at the awards themselves. And where do these ideas come from? And we go through all the stereotypes. And I don't shy away from terms, you know, like derogatory slurs. I use them in class, mm-hmm. whether they apply to me or others. And, you know, I don't use them on the first day of class because I think you need to establish community first and make people feel safe and understand that I'm using this for effect, not to offend. But I use those in class. And we go through things like, is it only Black people who really like fried chicken? Or do y'all like it too? And I'm looking at, you know, right? Or, yeah. And occasionally I'll have an Asian student. Like, I was really good at math, but my Asian colleagues were like, look at me like I'm, like, we go through these. And sometimes humor helps. And, you know, having that kind of personality where you can kind of like have that little satire in there helps. But we do not shy away from the experiences that people have in the real world and in classrooms. So I say, okay, teacher, you wanted to give everybody in an award. And I have my students rewrite them, right? Redo them. So you want to give everybody an award. What's a more appropriate way, a more inclusive way to do this? What are things that we can celebrate for every student that are not steeped in these kinds of oppressive ideas? And so they work through them. I use lots of case studies. Some are things that I've seen in my own teaching. Some are things that my former colleagues have shared with me and I kind of anonymize them. Some are from books that other educators have created, but they are often very realistic, very, you know, I want you to start thinking like a real teacher. What would you do? I love that TV show. What would you do? I need to do a teacher version of it. Like, so that so when we get students to confront, why do you think that Bob is ignoring you when he's not looking at you? Is it possible that he's just shy? Is it possible that, you know, in his family, kids don't look at adults in the in the eyes? You know, we can't keep assuming that there's this negative thing as the first thought. And that comes from not having conversations about how people learn. Also, not ascribing certain behaviors to everybody in a particular group, whether it's a racial group, a gender group, or whatever, because there's diversity within groups. You all know this, right? So we talk about that too. Like, yeah, I am a brown person, but I do not like pork at all. I hate it. I am a Black person and I love yoga. I like yoga. I like yoga. I like sea moss. I like seaweed. I'm the type of Black person they call crunchy. Like, I'm one of them, but I never see myself in those commercials, but I'm one of them. Right? And yep. So let's talk about the ways in which we even within groups, we are diverse. And so my critical conversations with students always start from the individual perspective, and then I widen it by offering different perspectives, and then I challenge even those widened perspectives, And then I ask my students to reflect and then make it very plain and very clear. I wrote an article for the International Literacy Association a couple years ago about confronting our shoulds and supposed tos. Those are dangerous because they're often layered in oppressive systems, right? So when we think about teachers and we think about how we interact with students, what are the things that you say students should be able to do? And why do you think that? Where did it come from? Are you basing what you think students should be able to do on your own experience that was very different, maybe, than the students that you teach? And if you have these supposed tos, where did those come from, right? If students should have a parent come to parent-teacher conference, who says that that's the only way to show involvement, right? Who said yeah. that? And if you have created a very narrow engagement strategy, I'm just using that as an example, are you really being inclusive? Are you really honoring the expertise and the experiences that maybe your kid has yet to show you because you've created a hole where he's a square or she's a triangle? Maybe not. So I ask my students to grapple with those. You want to be a teacher? Why? And this is what I'm doing this year. Because of everything that has happened with COVID and Black Lives Matter and politics and just the state of our society, I'm really digging into the question and motivations behind why people want to be teachers. Because we don't want to touch this, but oftentimes some of the reasons why we want to be teachers is to perpetuate what we think should happen. And remember, what those shoulds come from, they're often nice ways of saying, let's keep things the way that they are for certain people and not so much for others, right? And I'm not going to, you know, berate anyone, but you want to be an elementary school teacher so that you can do what? Well, let's think about that. Let's think about how that may perpetuate cycles of oppression, gender discrimination. How are you going to do that? So I'm having my students do narratives. I'm having my students really look at significant symbols in their own motivations, in their own educational history, little like signposts, if you will. What are the signposts that led you to this space? Like we talked about earlier in the podcast, we all have a road that has gotten us to this particular point. We have to interrogate the herrings, the red herrings on that road, to make sure that we're going in a direction that will not do harm, not to ourselves and not to the babies that we intend to teach. And whether you're a kindergarten or a 12th grader, I say the babies, right? and being honest about that. It's okay if you had a really great teacher in kindergarten and she did these activities, you know, had, you know, made y'all dress up like pilgrims and Indians, and you want to do that too. That there's nothing inherently wrong with wanting to connect with students in a way that make them feel seen. But that activity, we're going to talk about that activity, right? Because that's something in your mind that's motivating you to go into education. And it's creating all these shoulds. And it's limiting who has value, who has voice. And it's not historically accurate. That's what I do to help promote these critical conversations. No, connect the personal to the field, connect the field to the systems in our society.
I think, Em, that we should do that for our reflection episode. Next episode, we should ourselves ask ourselves that question. Because I would be like, I'm sitting here trying to, like, as you're doing the questioning, I don't know that I've asked myself that question, and I definitely haven't interrogated it in any kind of critical way. So I feel like that would be really valuable and really worth our time.
And I'm sorry, I'm so long-winded and I'm speaking in metaphors. It's a force of habit. If you need me to be metaphor, just say so.
No, trust me. Here's the thing. I would never want any guest, right, to shorten themselves, right? Like, for us on this podcast, we are here to learn, right? We're here. And part of the sort of thesis statement of this podcast, right, is that teachers always have to be learners, mm-hmm. That Emily and I want to be the best teachers that we can be. And if we have invited someone on, it's because we want to learn, right? Like, we're here to be students and then to take that and apply it and reflect in a really open and honest way, hopefully so that other teachers, right, whether they are, you know, in their student teaching process, like a lot of our, you know, sort of viewers are, or those who, you know, have been in the classroom for 30 years, can do the same thing. But I think it's so important that as educators, we're open about the process being messy, being something that changes, where you're interrogating, and where you're really trying to engage yourself critically as you're going through, that there's no such thing as like the perfect teacher who knows every single thing right from the get-go, that we're all sort of, you know, trying the best that we can. So no, that is a long-winded way of saying, you know, we're here to learn and we want to hear everything that you have to offer. So no worries.
Right. One of the things that I was thinking while you were talking was, because I'm the history teacher, right? So I've definitely been conscious of during when we do like special things, and some of this is like I'm so tied to the curriculum, but when I try to work in extra sessions and stuff, like I'm the history teacher that's always picking those, I don't want to say obscure, but like I don't pick Martin Luther King when I'm doing something special for someone. So like I'm always thinking about diversity and who I'm picking, and like Allison mentioned about trying to find those stock photos and stuff. But this year I am switching to a new curriculum. So I was teaching ancient history, so that had obviously kind of diversity built in because we hit around the world of different civilizations. But now I'm switching to civics, so I can work in a lot more of those current events, and obviously current events in our world right now, race, racial justice. But I'm a little concerned about that because I obviously, as a white educator, I feel like I don't have the skills to be able to moderate those conversations because I don't want to trigger my Black, Brown students. So what do you think is important for me to understand to help me guide those conversations throughout the year as we talk about these different current events to make sure that my students feel safe coming to me as a white educator guiding these conversations?
I think that that's an excellent question. I believe that anyone can have these conversations as long as they're comfortable admitting where they don't know, and especially to students. Not only does that model what it means to be intellectually vulnerable and resourceful and honest, but it allows students to disarm themselves and say, okay, this person is not trying to perpetuate something that they don't understand or they don't have a clear knowledge base to draw from. They are learning with me. And on top of that, they're not expecting me as a Black, Brown, you know, person of difference to be the spokesperson for every person who may look, behave, or have my ideological thought, right? So In situations like that, I think that's the first step. Whether you're a white educator who, you know, who feels ill-equipped, or you're a person of color who just doesn't think that these things exist, because these people exist too. And sometimes do more harm because, you know, and like I said, people have their beliefs, but everybody has the capacity to do harm, is my point. And so where that happens, where you feel ill-equipped or ill-informed, we do what teachers do best. Go get some research. Don't make your voice the only voice in the classroom. Give your students a choice as to when and how they enter into conversations. I love independent problem-based learning research projects. You go tell me. You become the expert. You go talk to your family members. You talk to your community members and bring that knowledge back to the classroom. One of my mentors early in my induction told me the person in the classroom doing the most work is the person that's learning. Give the responsibility to your students. And I'm not talking just about the ones who have the capacity, like, you know, we think about middle school and high school, well, they can do that work. Nuh-uh. Your four-year-olds can do it. Your five-year-olds can do it. Any child with the proper scaffolding can own their own knowledge and own some expertise. And that, I think, does wonders for having conversation, for opening to new ideas. And all your job is to facilitate and ask questions. You know, some people think it's the lazy teacher syndrome when the teacher just, well, what do you think? What do you think? No, it takes a lot of self-control and willingness to give up that control to allow a person to develop their own sense of inquiry, to explore their curiosities, right? So that's one thing that I say. The other thing is allow other people, adults, experts, to come into your classroom. We're moving into a space where everybody has more access to digital tools and technology, and you could talk to somebody in France if you really wanted to and compare the civics between the French system and the American system, and they could do something live or they could do something pre-recorded. You could just, you know, the way social media is, we can connect with the world. Use it. Now, granted, as the teacher and as the person who is making sure that your kids are not exposed to harmful things, you might want to have a conversation with the person beforehand and outline some questions. But, you know, that's what teachers do anyway. And a lot of people will say, well, just use Google. I'm not a fan of that because there's a lot of things, text and information out there that's misleading.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I would talk to someone, you know, at a local, you know, college or a civic organization. What are some resources? I have some seventh graders, right? I have some sixth graders that want to learn about X. You know, what are some resources that you may be able to connect me with, or people you may be able to connect me with? I think, depending on what the community situation is like, this is an awesome time to learn about civics or any subject for that matter, because we need opportunities to touch base with our communities because we're in quarantine. So if you tell your students, look, I want you to call your local representative's office, we know what's going to happen. They're going to get the runaround. They're going to talk to 15 different people. But that experience in and of itself is going to be informative, right? And if they do happen to get through, oh, wow, what will they bring to the classroom once that happens? And I just think giving kids time to do things, sometimes, especially now we are in this crunch of trying to figure out how to do things in this new paradigm, I am of the opinion the kids are going to be okay, right? Chloe and Hallie have that song, the kids are going to be all right. They are more resilient than we think. And as long as we're fostering opportunities for them to engage deeply, connect socially, and really grapple with some content, they'll be okay. We don't have to rush through this. Who says we have to do a project in a week? No one. Take 2 weeks. Take a month. Do what works for your kid. So just to like sum up, I said, give some ownership to your kids. Have them tell you what they want to learn. Make them read the newspaper. I was on a call the other day, and I said, and this is just my personal belief, let's revitalize the USPS. Go make everybody buy some stamps and have a pen pal. Yeah. If every student who stuck at home did that, we wouldn't have a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Second, involve parents, involve the community, involve like your content is civics. Okay. We can't go to the office building, maybe they can, but if they can't, the telephone works. Like everybody's so, you know, I'm going to text everything or I'm going to email everything. No, these people have jobs. Let's make them use their jobs. Call them, speak to them on the phone. We're developing those speaking skills, those patient skills, all of those things. And have them subscribe if possible, if they have the resources of the, you know, school or the library. Go get a newspaper, an actual newspaper, and read it.
I have visions of like guest speakers and articles, and so yeah, I'm that helps me because I'm on the right track with this plan that I have.
Yeah, just I feel like, you know, especially when it comes to like race, my white colleagues will say, well, I don't know where to start. Say that then. Say that to your students. Even if only the teachers, only the students you teach look just like you. I don't know where to start. I am going to make mistakes. I still have some beliefs that I'm still trying to reconcile, but my goal is to offer you something. And I'm going to do these things to make sure that something gives you more positive than negative perspectives. And then you move from there. And when you make a mistake or you say something offensive or you walk out a trope that's not quite right, apologize, move on from it, and don't internalize it. But always, always, always connect it to the system, right? So often, like I said before, we get caught thinking that this whole thing is like a personal thing. Is I don't treat anybody like this and I don't do that. That's nice, but it's not about you. It's about the whole system. And if we keep ignoring that, that system is going to remain.
I feel like this is a really perfect segue to sort of my ELA question. As all of our listeners can probably figure out, Emily and I picked one question sort of from our subject area expertise that we really wanted to sort of ask Nakia today. And one of the things that I hear you saying a lot in the response to Emily's questions is about getting students to interact with sort of modern texts. And one of the places where I really do feel like my curriculum is lacking is that we have, I think, a lot of very cursory moves towards diversity. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of texts that we read that are very purposefully from different points around the world, that are from different experiences, that are very clearly from authors talking about different perspectives. I don't think there really is a unit where we don't talk about race as some component of literary criticism, right? Because that's just good literary criticism. Mm-hmm. But, and this is my big but, I genuinely think for like cost and copyright reasons, we do not have texts that are contemporary, right? We read a lot of Langston Hughes, but we're not getting, you know, contemporary voices. And I wonder what your thoughts are as someone who is also an English nerd about what kind of service we're doing to our students by only having them read essays and short stories and novels, when in order for me to have a real conversation with my students about Black Lives Matters, I have to talk about hashtag. Mm-hmm. In order for me to talk about Breonna Taylor, I have to talk about hashtags. I have to talk about sort of the way that texts and ideas are discussed in our society, right? Mm-hmm. And while I think the essay is never going out of fashion, it's not, I think, the major way that we're doing discourse as a society. So in terms of preparing our students to enter the world and be able to have critical conversations and to be able to look and sort of honor these texts, what do you think are the important skills that we as educators in ELA really need to be focusing on? And are there skills or things that you think that we should be comfortable kind of letting go or maybe not spending as much time on to really make sure that our students are prepared?
That's a good question. And my little English nerd is kind of like jumping up and down in my body.
I hoped you would appreciate it.
So critical conversations in the humanities space, I think, suffers from an identity crisis, quite frankly. Because we are married to this notion of text that, despite all reality, is so old and so like seeped in white man. Mm-hmm. But everything else around us is not. And so, to your point, social media to me is text. Right? It is right. Something that can be read. It's something that can be digested. And if we think about Louise Rosenblatt's transactional theory of reading, right? You have a reader, you have a viewer, you have a text, and something happens in those intersections where we make meaning. If we don't realize that when you listen to a song, or hell, when you teach, that's a transaction. My dissertation was all about how teaching is narrative, all about how We create narratives, and it's a dynamic narrative. Every single time we get up or sit in front of or engage in the learning process with students, and where the text is the teaching itself. And so I truly believe we have to widen the scope of what it means to have and what it means to be a text-based society, because text is not just A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Remember, I was talking about signs and symbols before. That hashtag signifies something, and especially to our 21st century learners. If you use a hashtag on Twitter or Instagram or wherever, on Facebook, it is like a repository of information. You get a whole backlog of tweets, of pictures, of memes that are associated with this hashtag. That's like research 101.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I tell my students. Go do a hashtag. I actually teach a class called Social Media Youth Identity and Agency. And that we look at this very thing. Like, why is it that we talk about teaching and learning through books and films and maybe poems, but we don't look at teaching and learning that happens in real time on social media platforms or in music or on TV or wherever text exists, especially if you're using a more dynamic definition of it. One of the ways that I think we can complement some of the more traditional, antiquated modes of thinking is to infuse some of that into our lesson plans. Our students are looking at those things anyway. Our students are using those text-based platforms anyway. Why not? You need poets of diverse backgrounds? They exist all over Instagram.
Yeah.
You need representation in terms of content? It exists all over TV, in advertisements. I mean, we know this. So I think in terms of skills, like if I had to think of a skill set, media literacy. Yeah. I think infusing more media literacy and expanding the definition and the possibilities of what text means will equip students to engage with all types of things more critically. To be a reader is not just to pick up a book and look at words. You read people like that. That is in the lexicon now. I'm going to give you a read. Well, what does that mean? That means I'm going to assess you. I am going to look at you, observe your behavior, and give you critical feedback. Why are we not using that in ELA classrooms? Because it's ghetto, to use that word, or it's not proper English, quote unquote, right? But our kids, all types of kids, are using these things to describe themselves, to describe their experiences, and to communicate with one another. We don't want to get left behind where we, the older ones, you know, us teachers, are thinking and speaking in ways that don't move with society. That's why every time a platform gets inundated with adults, the kids find something else to do. Because we're not hip. Not that we're not hip, but we don't take the time to learn, and we often criticize. So I believe that's why Facebook is left to everybody over the age of 35. Mm-hmm. And the young ones are using other things. And TikTok and Snapchat and Yik Yak and all these dark underground modes of communication. Why not bring those things into the classroom? Have your kids create a platform. Okay, all the social media platforms are going to be erased. I would do this in an ELA classroom quick. What would you create and why would you create it? What types of texts? And, you know, you do the lesson on what it means to be a text, you know, symbols, what it signifies, and, you know, visual arts and all that, colors. Everything can be read. Everything can be read. What would you do? Some students may say, I'm going to create a platform that's all about the visual arts and the color red. Well, why? And then they'll start to develop those critical thinking skills, those communication skills, those analytical skills, those collaborative skills, and then you can complement those skills, reading comprehension skills, like, and then you, like, let's test it out. So let's create a few posts and let's see if your friends understand what you mean. Oh, that would be so fun. And then those things will translate and transfer into reading Macbeth or Beowulf or whatever else. And there's a place for those. I think we shouldn't erase them. Like, you know, one of my formative learning experiences, because I had never read Beowulf, and then I had to teach it during my student teaching. And I was like, oh, wow. What in the world is this? Like, Beowulf? Like, who is Beowulf? Like, what is this? I had never interacted with Beowulf. Who is Beowulf? He sounds kind of braggadocious. Like, who is this dude? And then I thought about my experience and the experiences of my students who were very, very much into early 2000s hip hop. Okay, now I see we can fuse Beowulf, who speaks so highly about himself, and Jay-Z, because they do the exact same thing. Do you know
I love it.
Teaching Beowulf so much easier?
I love it.
I mean, granted, now that's like almost 20 years ago, but I'm sure there's some similarities with what's going on now. And I think mm-hmm. what we miss is we stop asking students input. We just start assuming stuff. And like I said before, ask. They want to talk. They want to give us information all the time. Those people in the classroom doing the most work are the ones learning. Why are we stressing ourselves out as educators trying to do everything? We already have degrees.
You ask good questions. Good questions. Because like what I'm really hearing in terms of your answer, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff here about sort of redefining the text, right? Yeah. And critical thinking and thinking outside of these different ways. But there's a lot in here about student-centered inquiry-based learning.
Yep.
And there's a lot about creativity,
yep.
right? About sort of the freedom to make something yourself. And I do think that as an ELA community, we have been pushing more and more into these sort of nonfiction or informational texts, and in doing so, not allowing them to be creative, even though there's so much room. Like my head is like swimming listening to you sort of talk about all the different ways you could do this, and it's creative, right? There's creativity here, right? Just because we're doing a nonfiction text doesn't mean that it needs to be this kind of like dry, connectionless, like find the topic sentence kind of work, right? Like there's so much here. So I have a lot to ponder. That's excellent answer. Excellent answer.
I think about even like just news, like just looking at the current moment, like whether I agree or not, information has become creative. And I think that that is a space. Oh my goodness. That is a space to let our ELA students like just thrive. How can you write this in a way that it sounds actually accurate, but it's not? Go for it. Now, do we want to traffic in fake news? I don't know, I mean, some people might, but there's lessons to be had in how can we pull apart this journal article or this news article and decipher the creative elements found in it. Where can we find the logical fallacies? Where can we find the spin? Where can we find the imagination of this author?
I actually really like that for history class, because that might help them realize better what is fake and what is not.
Right. What did this author have to do in order to make it sound this way?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
I see a joint English history or English civics project coming up. I can like hear it in the back of my mind.
Alice and I read each other's minds sometimes. I love it. I actually would love for a quick minute to circle back to something that you said earlier in our podcast about the disparity in situation sometimes. So we're lucky in that we teach in a cyber school, and mm-hmm. our students come from literally all over Pennsylvania. So geography isn't a factor for us. We have students from Erie to Philadelphia to the New York border everywhere. But that means that we have students who are in the most rural, white, conservative parts of the state, to students that are living in inner city communities that are like exclusively black and brown. So because those students live in those very different worlds and are in the same class, they also obviously have very different lived experiences. So when we're trying to bridge these worlds to have these conversations, We ran into this at the end of last year, where sometimes we have those worlds really clashing, not only with the students, but also with the parents sometimes. So what are some things for us to try to keep in mind as we're dealing with both students and parents sometimes, as we're trying to bridge these two very, very different worlds in the same classroom?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I think this speaks to, I don't, you know, often teach online, but when, you know, because I'm at a university, I have the same issue. I have students from everywhere. And you said something about worlds clashing, and I just kind of saw like poof. And of course, you know, you have parents who have their beliefs and have their thoughts about things. My first inclination, as we are all preparing to start a new semester, a new school year, is allowing students, with your facilitation as an educator, to create some community norms. Because school in and of itself is a community, right? So whether they're logging in from Philadelphia or Erie or rural Lancaster or wherever, they're immersing themselves in a new community by joining the class. And so community norms that say things like, you know, what does respect look like? I don't like making them myself, because then that's just me making prime land and nobody has a say.
Right.
I'd rather have the students, and all students, I said, at all ages can do this, even littlest kids, and sometimes they do it better, can do this. You know, 3 to 5 things that we are going to agree to from the beginning. And then also, like, I tell my students, I'm also going to present and discuss perspectives equally. And if I'm not doing that, or if you feel that I'm not, bring it to my attention. And these are the appropriate ways you can bring it to my attention, so that they have space and they have a voice to say, hey, Dr. P, you spent real, like, 3 class periods talking about this, and we only spent 1 class period about this. Can we spend a little bit more time talking about this? Absolutely. And then when they say stuff like that, I'll say, would you like to collaborate with me so that we can do that in a more equitable way? Again, giving them ownership of whatever perspective and community context in which they're coming to. And of course, if it's a private meeting or a 5-minute conversation on Zoom or whatever to prepare, I'm still going to do what I do. I'm going to push. I'm going to prod. I'm going to pull those weeds a little bit. I'm going to tug at what you think. And if the parents want to be there, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do it respectfully as well. What I want to say for parents, because y'all have that that variable that I don't often have, but just sending a letter to parents, hey, you know, we're in unique times, and these are some of the things that I'd like to do with your student. I am not in the business of converting souls. That's what I would say. You can say whatever way you want. But I want to make sure that I provide your child an opportunity to engage with perspectives that are different from their own. And I'm going to do it in a way, I hope, that is as balanced and as productive and as positive as possible. Differing opinions exist. And like I told you before, I'm not here to convert souls. But what I expect from you as a parent who's going to journey with me in making sure your child get what he or she or they need out of education is to be as open-minded as you can be, and ask your student questions and give your student permission to at least think about some of the things they talk about. If at the end of it, they don't agree, that's fine. No worries. But in our classroom, I want to make a space where everybody's voice and opinion is not only just heard, but valued. Because I hate the word tolerated. Like, that sounds like a preteen who's standing in front of you, who has their eyes at the ceiling and sucking their teeth. That's what tolerated feels like.
Yeah, tolerated sounds that good. But I resonated with a couple of things there. I really like the idea of, like, having a specific I'm going to use the word procedure for lack of a better word, but like a specific procedure when a student feels like to come to you when their view isn't given as much airtime, for lack of a better word. And when you were talking about your student who comes to you, I taught when we were doing world history before, part of our world history curriculum included world religions. I'm no stranger to having parents upset at me for teaching different viewpoints. But every year it would never fail. Students would say, well, what religion are you? And I said, well, my goal is by the end of this course for you to not know what religion I am, because I will have taught them all so unbiasedly that you will not know. So I was like, so see, you tell me what you think by the end of this course. And usually by the end, they were like, yeah, I don't know. So so I'm like, all right, achieved that goal. So
yes.
I that resonated with me with what you said too.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we have the fourth wall, like in theater when it comes to teaching. Sometimes you got to engage the audience. And by that, I mean the parents. Like, just sometimes it's good to say, it's not like you're asking for permission, but you're like, you're welcome. Other times, depending on what it is, I just ask for forgiveness. You know, like, I'm just going to do it. And, listen, that wasn't my intention. You know, if there's anything that you can, we know what we're doing when we do that. It's a balancing act. So, I mean, if your goal is to have some of these conversations with their students, I would, me personally, I would give a very general, hey, this is what we're going to do. Given this time, I think it's important, especially because y'all have secondary students. I think it's important for us to acknowledge, I like that word, to acknowledge the current state of the world. And we will do that in a variety of ways. And I hope to do that with as much balance and equity of perspective as possible. Please take this time during this school year to ask your student questions, to engage with me in a, and this is how you can do that. But just know that, and me, like I said, I'll use the term, I am not here to convert souls. All I'm here to do is, if your child believes something, I want them to be able to defend it. I want them to be able to speak to the other side, because that's what good debaters do. And when your kid becomes president, they will be well-versed in how to present their opinion and facts well. That's it.
I like that. Maybe that'll help Allison.
Yeah.
Debaters need to know the other side.
Yeah. No, the language that you're giving is just so quality. And I think that it's what's wonderful about, I think, everything that you're saying is I feel like challenged in like an appropriate and like great way, I think, from our conversation, right? Because I think going into this, I definitely had a little bit of a preconception that so much of having really, inclusive and critical sort of racial justice, but also, I mean, larger sort of inquiry-based discussions, right, about our culture and about sort of why we operate the way that we operate was teacher-driven. Mm-hmm. And the more that we're talking and the more that we're really having this dialogue, the more I'm like, I have to be really comfortable with something that I know that I struggle with as an educator, right? This is one of the places that I know I'm not perfect at, which is trusting my students to really lead the inquiry and to make the rules and to sort of, have some space to really operate in uncertainty, right? I mean, as the adult in the room, it is always my responsibility to be the adult, right? And to be the planner. But I think the more that I'm talking with you and the more that we're sort of reflecting together on this process, I think the more that I am seeing how my thinking needs to shift as I'm getting ready for this upcoming school year to really be thinking about how am I making room for my students, right, to sort of question and to go back to something way at the beginning of this, right, to really tie it all back together, to maybe fail or to struggle in a way that is safe and productive for them. So thank you for that, because I really am thinking, I think, very differently at the end of this conversation than I sort of came in thinking.
No worries. I think, critical conversations And I said this before, maybe I didn't, but I think they don't have to be dialogues, right? We already operate in a space where silence and movement and connotation and body language and all kinds of things inform where we are, right? We know when someone doesn't like us, even if they don't say anything. With young kids especially, there are ways to have these conversations and not say a word, whether it's through play, whether it's through drama, whether it's through an object lesson like this is an egg. I don't know. I'm making this up as I go along. And so I think sometimes we forget, especially as we move through the spectrum of K through 12 and our students get older, we lose some of that wonder about how can I give this information or provide a space that this information is palatable and resonates and is engaging. We forget what we did with the little ones and we act like it's not applicable to the older ones. It is. Let them act a fool, especially in the cyber world, especially because that's what most of us are doing right now. Make them get up out of the chair and dance to a song and then think about it. Make them write in chalk on the driveway if that's what they have access to. And if they don't have access to that, you can do finger drawings with some dish soap, right? Mm-hmm. Let's imagine beyond what we've been so conditioned to do. And the conversation will then be more fruitful. Our students will have ownership of it. Like, nobody wants to be pulled through anything, right? So if I see myself as a valuable contributor and my voice matters in whatever we're talking about, race, racism, gender discrimination, whatever, I am more likely to engage with it. And then make them do the work. But also as the educator, model multiple ways how to do the work, right? And even if that means, look, I don't know what I'm doing, y'all, well, this is what we're going to try today. Tomorrow, we might try something else. Anybody have any suggestions? Yes, I do. That's what I think.
All I can say is that I feel like your students, whether they were your middle schoolers way back in the day or your current students, are so lucky to have you. Uh-huh. because it's so beautiful. And I almost don't want to ask this question because I know it's the last question of the podcast and I don't want this conversation to end. But it is a question that I think has been fruitful with all of our guests, and we'd love for you to speak to it today, which is, and I take this question sort of broadly, mm-hmm. Which is, what do you wish you knew before you got started? We do have, once again, a lot of young educators. Mm-hmm. And if you could speak to sort of an early you, what is the advice that you wish that you could give yourself, that thing that you wish that you knew? That was going to help you on your journey?
Oh, I think about this question all the time. My advice to pre-service teachers, new teachers, teachers of any stage in life and in the career, you are already an expert. You are already an expert because you know how to learn. You are already an expert. So much of those first few years, I wondered, am I doing this right? Does this make sense? I don't know what I'm doing. And it hindered my imagination. It hindered my ability to let go and lose control a little bit. Because sometimes in the space of chaos, you learn so much. You are already an expert because you have lived. Whether you lived in rural America on a farm with five brothers and you're the only girl, or you grew up like me in a major city with so many different people and voices and languages, all of those experiences inform who you are as a teacher right now, today, and who you will become. And don't be surprised when multiple students, multiple activities, multiple interactions you have with parents and families and communities start to shape you as you go along. Lean into that. Don't be so rigid in your experience of your expertise that you limit your capacity to grow, because your expertise does not need to stay stagnant. And if it does, that's when and where your usefulness as an educator will end. That's it.
Thank you for I can't say it better. Thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Truly, I think so many people are going to benefit from the wealth of knowledge that you brought. I think any one of the responses that you gave had a ton to really pull apart and think about, and hopefully challenge us in some great ways to be the best teachers that we can be. So thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you. And I appreciate you guys letting me be my verbose self. And I just thank you so much for allowing me to, you know, share my thoughts, my passion, and just know that you all can do this work however it manifests for you. We don't all need to be the same. And that's the benefit of living here in the United States. So good luck this school year to each of your listeners, and find me on the Twitterverse or email me. I'll gladly have any conversations with anybody. So thanks.
Thank you so much.
So if you would like to see even more from Nakia, you can find her at Doc Prime. The I is a one in Prime, guys. Check the show notes if you're looking for her Twitter handle. We will both definitely be following her, so you can also check our follow list. In the meantime, please keep in touch with us on our socials. We're on Twitter at Allison K Teaches and at Sattler Cypher. We always appreciate keeping the conversation going. Please like, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And keep trying hard.